of the conflict here, going back into the 90s. So again, we don't have the information on the ground. It remains to be seen exactly what occurred, but it seems a huge civilian loss of life, or a huge loss of life in this hospital.
Folks, I don't know that there, but that was Anderson Cooper correcting himself from accidentally saying civilian lives were lost in the giant explosion at a hospital. Upwards of, I think 500 was the early number that came in. Lots, I think more, hundreds more have been maybe added to that. And yeah, unsure if you can say civilians. But David, welcome. We're going to have another downer of a show because of the state of the world right now. But, you know, good to be with you.
Glad to be here with you. Glad to be here with all of our good listeners out there in solidarity with the people of Palestine. I mean, I know another heavy show. We have a conversation we'll be sharing in just a little bit with some nurses in New Jersey, who have been on strike for 75 days on the day. You know, and it's just another kind of example. Again, not trying to be too much of a downer, but it's tough, right? Another example of how, like, the cruel logic of austerity and penny pinching has real human consequences. So all solidarity with them too in their fight for a fair contract and their work to support their community and make sure that people stay alive.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
So, I mean, everybody knows what we're going to start the show talking about. I mean, it's been another week of just unending horror. I want to make a call on this program for something that can be done and something that I think is the baseline for supporting. But first up, I just got to say to you, Matt, I don't know how how you're feeling about this, but I have to say there's an aspect to this crisis that has been, you know, making me feel like I'm personally going insane, because, you know, for example, that the U.S. media are liars. When it comes to this issue, they have been for a long time. Gobble up any kind of propaganda, false information, as long as it you know, promotes Israel in a better light than the actual reality of an apartheid occupying government.
Pathologizes the objects of their who they're targeting their weapons at.
You know, and it's always been disgusting. But as we see the things that we've been seeing for the past, you know, 10 days, it starts to get even harder to believe just how far people are willing to go to deny the very real reality of of a conflict that is not equivalent, right? That these are is an asymmetrical conflict. Mm-hmm. That millions of people are now stuck in a prison that they've already been stuck in, that is now having bombs rain down on them. I mean, the bombs and the amount of weaponry that has been shot over Gaza in the past few days challenges like American interventions in wars with Afghanistan. I mean, it is truly devastating. The sheer weight of the munitions that have been dropped on the Palestinian people is horrifying. And I know everyone has seen some of these, you know, horrific videos of people searching the rubble for their family, for their children. You know, I saw one, you know, of a doctor who's been working under brutal conditions from the get-go, you know, finding out that their family, you know, had been killed. It's hard to watch in general. But there's a perverse aspect to it when you realize that all of this information that is out there, all this availability for this information, and you still have the people in power in this country lying through their teeth.
Yes.
Starting every phrase with, "We stand with Israel's rights to defend itself," and refusing to own what they are saying. Because when they say that, right, again, this is a classic move by people in the media, by politicians, to start talking about abstract, like, first principles, right? Instead of what they're actually doing, which is endorsing the wholesale slaughter of the Palestinian people in an attempt to implement a second Nakba on the Palestinians.
Yeah, I just have my thoughts going in like 8 different directions. So if you want to continue,
yeah, I mean, we got a lot of things to get to. So, you know, stop me at any time. I wanted to start here with Rashida Tlaib, who has been fairly fearless in coming out against you know, what's going on in Gaza. And I wanted to note, you know, we're going to talk about the ceasefire in just a second, but I wanted to note this really fast, because what she's doing right here, I think, is something that's critically important, is starting to make American politicians own what is going on there. Getting out of this kind of, talk about, what side do you think is right or wrong, whatever. And talking about the fact that bombs are being dropped on 2 million people, the vast majority of them children, and what that means. So Rashida Tlaib says, Israel just bombed the Baptist hospital, killing 500 Palestinians, doctors, children, patients, just like that. POTUS, Joe Biden, this is what happens when you refuse to facilitate a ceasefire and help de-escalate. Your war and destruction only approach has opened my eyes, and many Palestinian American and Muslim Americans like me, we will remember where you stood. And she is absolutely right in what she's saying there. And she's absolutely right in taking this fight directly. No more even talking about solely like Israel and condemning, you know, the actions of Netanyahu. Bring this shit home to the people who enable it. And that's people like Joe Biden. That's the vast majority of the Democratic Party and the warmongers within the Republican Party as well.
Yeah. On that note, Jeff Stein just reported that their word is on Capitol Hill that there's going to be a giant package, 100 billion. I was going to say that. I'm like, is that, yeah, $100 billion for Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. Yeah.
No, so, I mean, like, at a moment like this, you see something like this and you wonder to yourself, you know, will this be enough? And I'm sorry to sound naive, right? Will this be enough for the empire, for the cheerleaders of empire, for the cheerleaders of war, to see what it is that they're supporting and scale it back? And every message that we're getting from the Biden administration, I know we'll play something in a minute on that, from Joe Biden himself, from the vast majority of politicians in this country, is in fact saying the opposite, is that they want more. They want more of this senseless killing. They want more of this destruction. And it's amazing. We're all good lefties here, so we all know the slogan, right? We got money for war, no money for the poor. And it's truly amazing. We have Janet Yellen saying, hey, Janet Yellen at the Fed saying, we got plenty, to fund another war, in Gaza against, civilians. But yeah, you know, Medicare for all, you know, social policies, you know, that's, you know, we got to figure that where that money comes from. But yeah. For this, yeah, we're very happy to fund and produce and sell, by the way, the weapons that are being used to brutalize people.
Yeah. Do we want to play this clip of the spokesperson for the White House on the hospital?
Let's establish something really first. First, before we do that, the demand is simple. In general, it's like end the occupation, end apartheid. But there is a coalescing around a very simple principle that everybody should be able to support. Something that is absolutely necessary and should be common sense, and that is a ceasefire. And that is something that has been introduced by Congresswoman Cori Bush, DSA member. Mm. And I wanted to read it really fast. This is the resolution calling for a ceasefire. And I will just read the demands here. The federal government holds immense diplomatic power to save Israeli and Palestinian lives. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the House of Representatives urge the Biden administration to immediately call and facilitate de-escalation and a ceasefire to urgently end the current violence, and calls upon the Biden administration to promptly send and facilitate the entry of humanitarian aid. That's the demand. Right now, if you're sitting here watching this, I know, for example, the Democratic Socialists of America has a phone bank. Listen to us in the background. Go online, find that link, call up people. Call up Congress folk and say, support Cori Bush's amendment here. I know right now in terms of sponsors are people like Rashida Tlaib, Cori Bush, Summer Lee, Delia Ramirez, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Presley, Jamal Bowman, Andre Carson, Chewy Garcia. Chewy Garcia. I want to make sure I'm not missing anybody. Jonathan Jackson. Notably, Greg Kassar has not co-sponsored that. Nydia of Velasquez as well has sponsored that. Those are people you should be, you know, saying, hey, good on you for doing that, and get the rest of Congress off their ass to support this. This is common sense. This isn't even taking a hard position on ending the apartheid, right? Which is, should be a baseline position for people, but we know how fucking cowardly these folks are. This is a baseline. This is a simple demand. It's clear. It's righteous. And this should be the first thing coming out of your mouth when you're talking to anybody is, do you support Bush and Tlaib's ceasefire now resolution? And that should be a question that Joe Biden should have to answer, and every single person in Congress should have to answer that as well.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. I think it's extremely shameful that, as we mentioned last week, Anthony Blinken had tweeted that word, and then now apparently they're behind the scenes telling diplomats of other countries, no, cool it on talking about ceasefires, cooling out, stopping the bloodshed. And that is... being accomplice to genocide. Mm-hmm.
Do we want to play some of these words from the conspirers here?
The conspirers.
Yeah, we got the Biden administration clip.
Oh, yes, with Sabrina Singh. Yeah. Well, first, I want to say you were right to foreground the ceasefire thing, because there's... I am fairly dismissive of the controversy over here. I think it's fairly clear that Israel struck a hospital, and we'll set up some of the circumstantial evidence for that. But I think you're right to point out, like, that we need to establish the ceasefire thing first, because, you know, Crowder's in on this now. There are a ton of conflicting reports about the Gaza City hospital incident, but we don't have conclusive evidence. Could have been IDF? We'll just go into this. Could have been Hamas? Yes. However, what we are seeing is people rushing for clicks instead of seeking the truth. Be vigilant in what you consume and always skeptical. And I'm sorry, but like the truth is, regardless of what happened, it would not have happened if there had been a ceasefire called for last week and it had been agreed to. So you're exactly right. But what's curious about this is, the state of these things, again, fog of war, the state of which the set of facts that are officially reported by newspapers changes all the time. But we have this strike on this hospital. Massive amounts of casualties and atrocity. Just horrible to look at. And we have Sabrina Singh of the White House. What led up to this question right before this clip here is an ask like, do we want to put conditions on the military aid we give Israel? And it's not in this, but she says, no, we don't want to. So regardless of if it's true, regardless of if it's the one story from Israeli side that it was Hamas rocket accidentally hitting a depot or something, or that it was an Israeli bomb. The pretext has been set that if the latter is true, which in my opinion it is, we support that too.
From the beginning, what we have said is that governments like us, our democracies, is what separates us ourselves from Hamas. We certainly expect Israel, as with any ally or partner, to uphold the law of war. It should be very clear that Hamas is the one putting Palestinians or those in Gaza at great risk. I mean, they are putting their command and control units inside hospitals, inside areas where there are innocent civilians. So the fact that they've set up command centers at these hospitals just shows the brutality that they're willing to engage on, that they're willing to use civilians as a way to mask their operations, but also to see them as casualties. That's not how we democracies are going to, or how the secretary in his conversations with Minister Gallant, we have always emphasized that the law of war be upheld.
So first of all, this excuse about human shields, right, that you always get from Israel is just bullshit. It's bullshit in general. But let's look into the situation for a second as to what is happening in Gaza. Israel effectively controls the entrance and the exit to the area. They've put out these cynical calls on people to leave. People cannot leave. As we played last week on the Grisham stream, they have bombed the Southern Crossing as people are trying to leave, right? So can't get out. And now we're talking about internal displacement. Entire neighborhoods are being bombed over in Gaza. So you say, oh, you know, people need to go here or there. There is nowhere where there's not going to be civilians, right? Mm-hmm. So this excuse, right, that is being made here is bullshit. Because the fact of the matter is that Israel is bombing highly populated, dense areas of Gaza in an area where people don't have anywhere to go. We've seen some of the smoothest brains out there say things like, oh, well, all the people in Gaza, all the civilians in Gaza should just go out into a field. And just stand in a field and wait for this to get over, which is just, it's inhumane, it's insane, it's barbaric, and it's bullshit. If these fucking people who sit their entire lives in comfort saying, oh, what we need to do is people go with no resources, no water, no medicine, no food, just go stand out. Just go stand out in the desert. Bullshit. Mm-hmm. An excuse waiting for an atrocity. And what I mean by that is it doesn't matter what happens. That's what they will always say. And that's what they have always said.
Yeah. And I'll just add that what it also is on top of bullshit is projection. This is from Human Rights Watch. Israel repeatedly blamed Hamas for the deaths of Gazan civilians during the operation because Israel says Hamas fought from populated areas and used civilians as human shield. That is, deliberately used civilians to deter attacks against Palestinian forces. In the killings documented in this report, Human Rights Watch found no evidence that the civilian victims were used by Palestinian fighters as human shields or were shot in the crossfire between opposing forces. In each of the incidents, Israeli forces appeared in control and Palestinian fighters had left the area in question. Civilian victims were in plain view and posed no apparent security threat. Continuing on, seven neighborhood residents who spoke to Human Rights Watch said that a major fighting in the area had stopped by the morning of January 7th, although sporadic exchanges of fire may have continued after that. In three cases documented by Human Rights Watch, starting on January 5th, the IDF detained Palestinian men from the neighborhood and forced them to perform dangerous tasks of a military nature, such as searching Palestinian homes. In two of these cases, Israeli soldiers stood behind a Palestinian man who was forced to search a home, deliberately using civilians to deter attacks on military target is considered human shielding. The use of civilians as human shields or to engage in work for military purposes violates international law. Now, unlike the spokesperson for our country there, I am not going to say that that justifies killing Israeli civilians then. They are saying that, you know what, it proves Hamas barbarity that they're willing to put facilities in a hospital. What does it say about us that we're willing to bomb all those civilians because there might be some our intelligence says there might be some Hamas activity there? I think that says a little bit more about our brutality mm-hmm. than theirs.
Absolutely. So should we talk a little bit more about we have more clips to get to, but let's talk a little bit about the humanitarian situation.
Oh, sorry. I have two more things on this. I just got to put in the Please. Record. Just so first, 3 days ago, the World Health Organization posted this, felt the need to do this because this isn't the first hospital that's been blown up. I think it's maybe just the biggest and, most active. It's
filled with people. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, but evacuation, but yeah. Okay. So this is to the other hospitals, right? That we're just like glossing all over in this over who did what, when. It's a mystery fog of war. What's not a fog of war is that hospitals have been bombed and evacuation orders have been admittedly given to these hospitals. And World Health Organization has this long tweet from 3 days ago. And what's even more damning, I think, than that is yesterday, the BBC with this tweet, right here. Does Hamas build tunnels under hospitals and schools? Hashtag BBC, your questions answered. And I don't know what that is, except setting the pretext for we're going to bomb one of these things and we want you to think it's okay because they're terrorists there.
And on top of it, Matt, I'm sorry, to do structural damages to the tunnels, you're not going to be able to do that with air munitions, right? So the plan with the air attacks is to slaughter a significant amount of civilians, to clear out areas to prepare for a ground invasion where then the Israeli military can come and destroy those tunnels at close range. So because to actually have a bomb drop that would be able to do structural damage to a tunnel underground, it would have to be a magnificently brutal weapon. So it's bullshit. Bombs.
Yeah. Is that what Hirsch is saying, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now let's look at this. Because this is just like to remind people what this is like for people in these hospitals, like the one that was bombed today. This was a call from just a couple days ago about the situation in Gaza in the hospitals from a Palestinian doctor.
the casualties. This will affect the admitted people in the hospital. In the hospital, we don't only have patients. We don't only have the casualties that we have treated. We have many civilians. They came to the hospital to find a safe place. We have more than 2,500 people who are in the hospital. So this will affect the staff. This will affect our work. This is an urgent appeal. Please, if you are a human, I'm not calling the Arab, I'm not calling them Muslim countries only. If you are a human, please, this is an urgent appeal. Please stop this. Save Gaza. Please support Gaza. We have no medical supplies. We have no gas, no food, no medication. We have nothing. This is an urgent appeal. Please stop this humanitarian crisis.
Thank you.
And, you know, this gets to just some nuts and bolts of it, right? Not to be too clinical about it, but the reality is here is like the human catastrophe is brutal enough, even if they had fully stocked supplies of water and food and medicine. But we're hearing horrific stories of people being washed with soap before mm-hmm. surgery because they don't have, you know, clean tools or ability to sanitize things. There is some updates in some of the things that the Israeli government has allowed to go into Gaza. Notably, as people know, Israel has shut off the water and the food and the medicine from going into the area. But recently, in eastern Khan Yunis, the water supply has been resumed by Israel. But because of the structural damage done by the bombing, it's sort of useless.
Exactly.
Add to that fact that there is virtually no fuel in Gaza, very limited. So the ability to be able to pump water throughout Gaza is non-existent. So it's one of those, again, really, it's almost cruel. You know, it'd be like standing in front of a thirsty person and pouring a bottle of water on the ground and tell them to drink it is basically what's going on with the water there. This is basic. I mean, this is just why I was saying at the beginning of this, Matt, that it's so horrifying to see what we're seeing out of Gaza, and then just so frightening to see the blasé, casual attitude that a lot of American politicians have to this crisis, talking out of both sides of their mouth, frankly.
It's interesting because, you know, I think the difference is the post 9/11 and through run up to the Iraq War period was a completely different media environment, much more corporately controlled. And so the idea, like the extent that you had a critique of that, it was because you subscribed to very marginal sort of ideological outlets, and you felt complete. And I was a kid at the time, right? But like now it's like we have a much more robust way of discussing these things. We've also been through the dress rehearsal, which was the war on terror post 9/11, which is that, yeah, like maybe we should look inward into what we're doing in the world rather than just say, like, we're going to pathologize an entire group of people halfway around the country and bomb the shit out of them for a few years. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, but the policy hasn't changed. Like the environment has changed, but the policy hasn't. And that's why it's so fucking insane right now.
I think you're right. Let's turn to the media just briefly. I will say the media in large part has vastly discredited themselves, already discredited. You know, and it's just one thing in the United States in particular, that under Trump, there was all this talk of, like, you know, fake news and like the threats of the press that Donald Trump represents. I mean, absolutely. Donald Trump is a pig and he didn't want anyone to report on him. But there was this kind of bizarre remaking of history as to why so many Americans were not trusting the media in general. It's because the media has been shown time and time again to lie, to underemphasize things and to overemphasize others. And this has just been a crash course in that experience. So I wanted to, you know, to play. So, you know, we've played a lot of the awful media coverage. You've seen, particularly CNN has just put out just garbage after garbage, just a steady flow of shit, you know, using, you know, all these terms. It's Palestinians die, Israelis killed, right? Yeah. All this kind of stuff, you know, who knows why it happened. So anyways, we want to take a moment to, you know, to shout out some good coverage from today, from MSNBC, from MSNBC reporter here on this hospital bombing and saying exactly the responsible thing that a journalist should say. Because the fact of the matter is, because Israel has basically blocked reporters from being able to operate in Gaza, and the people who are operating in Gaza, like, for example, CNN, you know, multiple journalists who have been killed, you know, it's hard for us to get information out there. So, you know, if you're in a media position, you want to sort of be accurate about what you can confirm and what you can't confirm. And I think this is the exact way to do it, which is using some rationality to describe it. I will just note for anybody who thinks that we might have edited this, I had to pull this together really fast. So I stitched it together. You can watch the whole clip. I didn't edit anything. It's just a little sloppy merch here. Anyway.
Well, this is an absolutely classic fog of war situation, and we should be really clear. NBC News is not able to get into Gaza right now. The Israeli border is sealed. The Egyptian border is sealed. Our teams are not able to get there and to verify this directly. We should also say that the Israeli military at this point is not providing any evidence to back up its claims that this was a Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket. They are citing intelligence that they have not yet made public. We should also say that this kind of death toll is not what you normally associate with Palestinian rockets. These rockets are dangerous. They are deadly. They do not tend to kill hundreds of people in a single strike in the way that Israeli high explosives, especially these bunker buster bombs that are used to target these Hamas tunnels under Gaza City, do have the potential to kill hundreds of people. And we should say finally that there are instances in the past where the Israeli military has said things in the immediate aftermath of an incident that have turned out not to be true in the long run.
And exactly.
One example I'll give you is that when the Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was killed in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli military initially said that she was killed by Palestinian gunmen, and it was only months and months later that they admitted that it was likely an Israeli soldier who fired the fatal shot.
Good on them. And, you know, very happy to say, you know, two thumbs up on that. But frankly, it's ridiculous that you know, yeah, very level-headed, typical reporting there is notable in this situation.
No, I mean, that's another thing I wanted here's a little bit of philosophy as far as like what our job is. There are some people who think that they need to model the proper ways of mourning and the proper language for their audiences about atrocities around the world. And that's why we're here. And there is what I think, which is that we, to the extent we can, try to influence and discipline power. And so, like, this fixation that, like, just in his example, Zach Beauchamp of Vox, both the pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel folks I follow are absolutely convinced the other side is responsible for the hospital explosion. Seeing the two polar opposite narratives emerge immediately in the absence of decisive evidence either way. And it's just like, why are we taking this in a vacuum? Why do the people who, like, there is clearly, as we said, like, a history of mendacity about these matters, particularly people being killed by the Israeli government or agents of them and them lying about it until the heat dies down. And so, like, that is the interesting thing here, not that people are tribal. That it's so appalling to me. That's anti-democratic. Like, how can we pathologize you motherfuckers that have no actual, like, ability to influence this, whether you're, like, you know, scared on behalf of Israel or, you know, defending Palestinians' right to exist and not be genocided. Like, this is on power, and power is lying about this stuff all the time. And so, like, I'm not here for this. Wow, look at these people running with fake news and not ver-. Like, okay, do that for journalists, of course. But, like, that people might have, first of all, it's nothing fucking new. Like, look at any conflict. Like, the Spanish Civil War is a famous one. I've read about it a lot. And the atrocity stories were the main object of propaganda for every side. And so, like, that's not new, but, like, what is new is what that guy's doing, which is putting this in a broader context. So, yeah, man, I mean, great job there.
Yeah. And, like, and I also want to be clear here too, is that even while we can talk about the editorial line of some of these outfits, you know, there are incredible people working for CNN and a lot of these organizations that do try to fight and push these things through. So I don't want to, like, it's one thing to, like, understand the general tenor of what you're going to get from a lot of these sources. But I just want to be careful that we don't get too sloppy, because there are people who are trying to do real work, particularly on the international core for a lot of these outfits, right? But as you were just saying, Matt, like, it's like, you know, it's knowing, particularly if you are familiar at all with the occupation, Israel's activities from the get-go, they have always done this kind of misleading stuff. And then, you know, 4 or 5 months later, say, oops, yeah, actually, like, that thing that we fed to the media and everybody ran with was wrong. So sorry, yeah. Folks, and move on. And nobody
cares. And thanks for not making us pay a price. Yeah.
And it's also notable that, you know, as the official account of the Israeli PM tweeted out just this afternoon, this is a struggle between the children of light and the children of darkness, between humanity and the law of the jungle. That, you know, it's probably not hard to believe that people who are tweeting things like that out might be calling strikes on hospitals.
Yeah, I can't tell you how much I like to see people defending Israel's actions in the past few days. Getting my replies calling me Nazi. Knock yourself out.
Yeah, pretty gross. Well, I mean, there's just so much, and we could sit here you know, all night going on about this, and I'm happy to spend as much time as we need on this. I wanted to do a quick update on a news story that I think people have been sort of missing, obviously because what's going on in Gaza, but also missing what's going on within Israel. Within Israel, Palestinian Israeli citizens are being abused, being arrested, being attacked across the board. In the West Bank, this is there has been a massive uptick in violence. Settlers have killed 51 Palestinians in the West Bank since the beginning of this recent conflict. In fact, two villages, and this is from, I'll pull this up for everybody. This is from The Intercept. Israel settlers take advantage of Gaza chaos to attack Palestinians in West Bank. At least two villages, Al-Kanab and Wadi al-Sik, have been entirely depopulated as a result of the violence by Israeli settlers. A Palestinian in at Tuwani, a village in Masafer Yatta, is in critical condition after a settler accompanied by a single Israeli soldier invaded the community on Friday and shot him at point blank range. I do not have the heart to expose y'all to this video that is linked here. It is extremely brutal, yeah. Graphic. And you know, just remember too, you know, if people want to know what's been going on in the West Bank, we had Basil Adra on the program over the summer to talk about the increase in violence against Palestinian children, including stories like the IDF attacking a primary school, for little children, and throwing stun and smoke grenades into a classroom while children are being instructed. That doesn't even begin to talk about the violence and the death and the murder that people are experiencing there. But these are places that have always been facing brutality, and this uptick is extremely worrying. Last kind of update before we maybe talk a little bit more about the political media situation, Matt. I just did want to note for people, this is sort of breaking, and I don't want to be irresponsible by saying more than I know, but in the West Bank and in Ramallah in particular, there have been massive protests of Palestinians and clashes with security forces of the Palestinian Authority. And I have seen reporters from Mondawise who have said that multiple shots have been fired into the crowd. I do not know the full extent of that, so I won't report or speculate any further from that. But just know that in the West Bank too, there are now not only settler violence and violence from Israeli IDF soldiers, but there's also a conflict around the Palestinian Authority that's going on. So I wanted to end on two last clips here. And I think the last one people have seen, but I wanted to do a quick shout out. There's plenty of leaders across the globe who are worth you know, shouting out, people like AMLO, Evo Morales, you know, who have been taking a lead in supporting Palestinians. But I want to note this from Podemos. And this is a way for people who aren't directly in power to advocate for different way of being in the world. So we need to do a big Spain update. But there is a coalition, a partner government between Podemos and the Socialist Party in Spain. And Podemos is now calling on that coalition government to take a harder stance in favor of Palestinian human rights and an end to the brutality and the warfare on the people in Gaza. So this is a statement by Ione Bellera, and people should watch the entire thing. She talks about the occupation. She talks about the humanitarian crisis and lays forward a four-point plan for what's needed. But I want to note one thing that they noted that I think takes a lot of courage, and I'm happy to see coming from Podemos in Spain.
En segundo lugar, solicitamos a nuestro socio, el Partido Socialista, que trabajemos juntos para presentar desde el Gobierno de España una petición ante la Fiscalía de la Corte Penal Internacional para que se investiguen los crímenes de guerra cometidos en Palestina por Netanyahu.
So for people who are listening and don't speak Spanish, what she was saying there is that she's calling on the Socialist Party to join Podemos. They're in a coalition government to draw up prosecution documents against Netanyahu for the genocide that is occurring in Palestine. She did not use the word genocide. She used the war crimes that are happening in Palestine. So shout out to Podemos for taking a strong line on that. I've had criticisms of Podemos in the past, but I'm very happy to see that.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. And more of that, you know, the better.
And last thing we're going to play is something I think a lot of people have seen, but it's just so disgusting, and I think it's worth putting up again. What we have seen in the American media landscape has been horrific. In Germany, they have been shutting down protests run by Jewish people, by the way, in Germany having protests in support of Palestinian human rights. In France, pro-Palestinian statements along with actions have been banned. So there's a real attack on free speech across Europe right now. There's a media attack in this country. We've seen professors writing letters saying that their students, their law students, shouldn't be able to get a job. You've seen the doxing of the Harvard students. I mean, you know, you could go down a long list of the intimidation of voices in this country. But in Europe, there's an actual government crackdown on these kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to note, sorry, here from Ryan Grimm hour ago. Crap, where did that article go? I just retweeted it. Oh, damn. Intercept just reported that. Where are my tweets at? I'm sorry, I keep going, David. I'll find this. I don't want to characterize it.
No, I mean, I'll just say before.
Oh, yeah, here it is. This is the Starbucks suing its union after solidarity with Palestine tweet saying that they're making us look like we support terrorism. It's outrageous.
Outrageous, extremely disgusting. There was a really nasty hit job in the Daily Beast attacking Brianna for what she's been saying on the Hill. That was extremely alarming, disgusting. Obviously stand with Brie against those freaks. I'm very happy to see her holding the line against them.
I've had my disagreements with Brie, definitely, but I did watch her disagreement with Robbie Soav, who accused the left of basically being Hamas sympathetic, and the Vanguard did a good segment on it. Just insane.
So obviously stand with her in that, and very happy to see her holding the line and not backing down. Not that I would think that she would. Last I'll play. Everyone's seen this. I just want to play it again because this is just so disgusting. This is like out of all these clips, we've played a lot of them. There are so many horrific videos, so many horrific things that have been said, and certainly things that have been done. But there's just something about this kind of denial that takes the level of cruelty to the next level. And this is an Israeli government official being interviewed in the United Kingdom on what's happening in Gaza. And the clip speaks for itself.
What's the view on the humanitarian crisis in Gaza this morning?
There is no humanitarian crisis because
there isn't.
There is no. Israel is in charge of the safety of the Israelis. Hamas is in charge of the safety of the Palestinians.
We've been showing pictures this morning that would illustrate that there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Are you a mother?
Yes.
What would you think if your children would have been executed in front of your eyes? Would you expect your government to think about those Nazis committing those crimes and to say, wait a second, first of all, we need to protect the enemy, and then to protect my children? Your children come as priority to your prime minister.
We have been showing images this morning that illustrate that there is a humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
So blame Hamas and ask Hamas why they started those atrocities walking around.
So you acknowledge that there is a humanitarian crisis?
I'm saying there is no. Israel is working.
So what do you think is happening?
What is happening? There is a war in Gaza, a war that Hamas started by committing a horrible massacre on innocent Israelis. The world has seen it.
Wait a second. Innocent civilians.
Just I want to say and give a little bit of a context. Those people created crimes that are worse than ISIS. When the Americans started this fight of ISIS, together with the coalition forces, over 100,000 civilians got caught in a crossfire. Israel is trying to prevent that. Israel is better than any other army in the world. We are alerting, we are giving them the opportunity to have a shelter. We are doing things that no other Western army did in the past.
It's truly, truly, truly despicable to be talking like that. You know, and in fairness, we will say this is before the bombing of the hospital. As everybody knows, there have been many, many just brutal murders of children in Gaza since the beginning of this conflict. And to just sit here and to just deny reality, not even to like, look, we know what Israel is. We know what Israel represents. We know what the intentions are. So I don't have any expectations of an Israeli official to come out there and say, oh, you know, I have a lot of sympathy for them. But this goes beyond just sort of defending your position to just straight up lying about the reality that is ongoing. And again, the United Kingdom's media has been bending over backwards to deny the atrocities in Gaza. This is your home court, effectively. You can say almost anything. Even in that, right, there's still a need to just not be able to recognize the humanity of Gazan people as people are being bombed, and then the people who are surviving are being starved and dehydrated to death. Yeah.
I mean, this is why I've just thought all the scolding of the left for saying you think it's good that those Israelis were killed because you support collective punishment. I'm sorry. That needs to be directed the other direction. Because you see statements like that, and again, like I honestly think those people, you could say, like, look at, here's a number of children who have been killed in these in this response, and they'd say, sorry, it's Hamas. And I mean, Mark Lamont Hill, right? With that, a member is like you said, like I understand that you're saying that, but that what you're outlining is collective punishment, and like it just is. And there's. Yeah, we're underwriting one of those.
Yeah. So I know this has gone a little longer than intended, but it makes sense. Mr. Joe Biden is going to be visiting the area tomorrow. Don't have very much in terms of expectations there. I think Joe Biden is doing something that he's very comfortable doing, which is being the press release president and saying one thing. You've been seeing he's been softening up a little bit his rhetoric while still supporting fully this operation. It's disgusting when he does that on things like healthcare in this country, when he does like that on things of the experience of working class people in this country. It's quite another when literally bombs are being dropped overhead on people and you are backing that and saying, oh, I'm so sad about this. Despicable. Yeah. The only sane and reasonable choice, the only way to cultivate or recoup any level of humanity for somebody like Joe Biden is to fervently support the ceasefire demands of people like Cori Bush and Rashida Tlaib. That is the only humanitarian option. And the long term, not even long term, because we could do it tomorrow. It'd be tough. It's a lot. And the occupation and the apartheid. This doesn't look like it's going to be calming down anytime soon. the world has seriously forever changed after this. And we will continue covering on this program and trying to lend space to particularly Palestinian voices and to uplift their humanity in this, something that they always have to assert for themselves, because it's denied to them by the Israeli government, by the American system, and by our media.
Well said.
Friends, we're going to go to this interview on another pressing issue here about nurses in New Jersey who have been on strike for 75 days. Please, if you are in that area, if you work in the medical industry, there's ways that we outline towards the end how you can support them. So please stick around for this interview. It's a really good one. And then after that, Matt and I will be going over the post game. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We'll be taking some questions and calls from all of y'all, along with a couple other stories. So come and see us on the other side.
Yeah, and you know, I'll put this in the show notes here, but safestaffingnj.org is the website you'll want to go to for this. So yeah, we'll see you folks for the post game. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me is David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, brother. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. And joining me are nurses Aaron and Sophia, here to talk about a nursing strike that's going on in New Jersey. Aaron, and let's start with Aaron, you first, and then Sophia. Describe your roles, yourselves, your roles in the hospital you guys work at.
Sure. Hi, my name's Aaron. I am an ICU nurse in Robert Wood Johnson in New Brunswick, New Jersey. I've been at the hospital for about 5 years. I work in the medical ICU, and you know, we've been on strike for 75 days now.
My name's Sophia. I'm also an ICU nurse. I've also been at the hospital for 5 years in different roles before I became a nurse. I've sort of risen up through all the floors of the hospital, from the ER now into the ICU. And I went to the university that is most associated with our hospital. I went to Rutgers, which has a partnership with our hospital through the medical school.
Very nice. And yeah, you know, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but you'll get into, like David, you were saying, the roles, the in sort of the best scenario, your job description, and then, you know, some of the other demands placed on you.
Sure. So, you know, in an ideal situation, you know, as an ICU nurse, I would have two patients. You know, we work 12-hour shifts and work overnight. So, you know, my job duties are to make sure that my patients are, you know, clinically stable. We have very critical patients. The New Brunswick Hospital actually is the flagship hospital of the hospital system that we work for. It's a level one trauma center, a designated stroke center. A lot of the sister hospitals in the area, actually, when the patients are too sick to be taken care of, will actually get transferred into our hospital in New Brunswick, and a lot of times actually into our unit to take care of. So we are dealing with some of the sickest patients in the state. You know, the reason that we are on strike right now is for safe staffing, because a lot of times, you know, we're asked to take care of more patients than, you know, we're actually supposed to be able to handle. And our job duties go beyond just, you know, clinical patient care. You know, we have to coordinate across many different disciplines in medicine, between the doctors, radiology, even like the kitchen and housekeeping. You know, we have to coordinate all of that. We have to be the primary point of contact for family members and keep them updated. You know, there's a lot that goes into it, more than just, you know, taking the clinical picture of a patient, administering medications or, you know, doing procedures on them, and then going home. You know, it's really an all-encompassing, holistic role of a nurse.
Especially in the ICU. Before I worked there, I worked in a floor that would take ICU downgrades, a medical surgical floor that was like a step down unit to the ICU. on floors like this with such high acuity and such sick patients, because our patients really are some of the sickest in the state and sometimes from other states as well, because we can provide specific surgeries or procedures that other places just can't. We are the coordinators of care for these patients. We are the people arranging their physical therapy, occupational therapy, the way that they are able to eat, being able to move around, get accustomed to whatever surgery they got or whatever procedure they went through, and essentially making sure that every aspect, getting them back to normal life, is happening for them. We are like their cruise ship director for their entire hospital stay.
And can you define for folks safe staffing? Because, you know, Sudha Bhattacharya, who has this piece, quoting at least you, Sophia, it mentions that this has been an issue that nurses around the country have won strikes on. But just for define folks what safe staffing is.
Safe staffing is based on evidence-based research. It is specific nurse-to-patient ratios based on acuity and based on the specific patient care area, saying that this many patients is appropriate for this kind of nurse, and this is the kind of ratio that must be upheld so that we can provide the utmost care for our patient population. When we disregard these ratios that are proven in the research, we notice that patients end up sicker, more sentinel events happen, like injury to patients, medication errors, or otherwise coordination of care is lacking. So with this ratio, enforcing it has never really happened in our hospital and across many others, which is why so many people go on strike for safe staffing ratios. If we're unable to provide the correct amount of nurses for patients, our patients are the ones who suffer the most.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like the public's sort of desire to also want you guys to get that assured by the hospitals, like, that should be fairly clear. You go in a hospital, you want to be, you want to make sure there's enough nurses on staff. Now talk about, like, so some of these hospitals, they do have these, oh yeah, we'll do safe staffing, and then there's like ways they get out of that.
So what
ends up happening is, you know, they'll put in what they call safe staffing guidelines. But the thing that makes a guideline different from a policy is that a guideline is not enforceable. So the thing that we've really been fighting for on our contract is to have enforceable safe staffing policy put in place. So some of the things that the hospital tries to do to actually get around the safe staffing is, you know, they'll look at that nurse to patient ratio that we're supposed to have, and then they'll count people like our managers into that staffing ratio. And they'll say, oh, you guys do have enough people for the nurses. Or they'll say that if a nurse calls out sick, they're not going to be responsible to uphold that staffing ratio because it's, you know, the nurse's fault that the floor is short-staffed. They also do, you know, I won't get too into the weeds with it because it's a little bit complicated, but they propose something that they're calling a core deficit, which pretty much means that they would only uphold staffing ratio if our staffing levels drop below a certain percentage. What that means is if we have a unit that has 10 nurses and they say our core deficit is 17%, you can't, if we're lacking one nurse, you know, they'll say, well, you're not under 17%. So we actually have to be below two nurses to get that. Instead of just going based off of raw numbers that says for each nurse that has an extra patient, this is the penalty. They're saying, well, you know, let's find a bunch of different ways to work around it. And this is actually, even beyond staffing, just something that hospitals do across the board that I think probably a lot of people aren't really aware of. They find ways to like fudge numbers everywhere. You know, our hospital is actually the largest private employer in New Jersey. And, you know, they're constantly going on and on about, you know, all these different stats and metrics that they are hitting, but a lot of those numbers are fudged. Like recently they actually remodeled the emergency room to decrease wait times by just making the waiting area smaller. So instead of people waiting in the waiting room, they're now waiting once they get into the ED, and that's not counted as a wait time. So they do that kind of stuff when it comes to like our staffing ratios and really just anywhere that they can find to try and like make themselves look better and get away with not doing the right thing, they'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, the prerogative, because you mentioned the evidence-based safe staffing, you know, conclusions that have been arrived at by people not, you know, motivated to save money on the bottom line, but actually to save lives. And to put up against, like, I'm sure that 17% number, that wasn't arrived at by the evidence-based process. That's just something they added to, you know, give themselves a way out.
Yeah, that would never be something that the nursing research would provide for, especially because, like, how are you going to have 17% of real people in the numbers? It's not whole numbers. It's not whole numbers. So it's just, it gets around the problem entirely. It's just another tactic to get around the core issue, which is that if we don't have the right amount of nurses, we cannot provide the right kind of care for our patients, especially because if we're going to be a level one trauma center, a nationally recognized stroke center, a certified cancer center, and provide all of these services that you can't get anywhere else, there's not one hospital in the area that has all of those things at the level that we do with the amount of nurses and staff that we do. If we can't provide the correct staff for that, we can't actually execute that higher level of care.
So like on this, like, because this is something that we're seeing across the board in like the labor movement, right, is like fighting over scheduling, right? One, because of how abusive it is for people who are laboring, right, to have to pick up extra work. But two, because there's like, you know, dramatic safety concerns, like, for example, the railroad workers. This was one of the big things that they were, you know, fighting about, because they were having too few people on those trains to be able to make sure that they were safely staffed. Just so the audience is really clear, when y'all are going into these contract negotiations, in these negotiations, are the people y'all are negotiating with the people who are usually walking around the floors of the ICU area or things like that during the day, or is this a different kind of group of folks?
No. So the the negotiation team for the hospital is all administration staff, people that we don't see on the floors. It's a very large hospital system. I think something like 12, 16, some above 10 hospitals in the system. And, you know, like I said, it's the largest employer in Jersey. It's 37,000 employees. These people are not present. You know, they don't care about patient safety. They see patients as names and numbers on a spreadsheet. It's all statistical. They're really so far removed from the human element of it. Just to give another example with a way that they get out of these staffing ratios is just in the last contract that we voted down to go on strike, they had actually written in wording that would absolve them from staffing responsibility in the case of a public health emergency or a mass casualty event. And just coming out of, you know, the back end of the COVID-19 pandemic, which really exposed like a lot of the issues that have been going on for so long, for them to write out language that, you know, absolves them during a public health emergency was, you know, it was insulting, and it was really so counterproductive to any protections that we would put in place.
Yeah.
Can you just describe? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, sir. I was curious. Can you just? Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry.
I just want like your descriptions, like help people understand what it's like to go into a shift that's short staffed.
We are not as short staffed in the ICU as we really are on the medical and surgical floors. I worked on the trauma surgical unit for almost 2 years as a nurse, and we would often, our census was to have 9 nurses, and that was fully staffed based on the amount of patients that we could support on the unit. I would often walk in and we would have 3 on the schedule, and we would be calling the nursing office and administration left and right to beg for float nurses and support staff because we could not get through the day. And managers were taking assignments, directors were taking assignments, and it was really scary. Walking into a shift like that when you know you're going to be taking care of an unsafe amount of patients with few resources, often doing the jobs of other people because we're also short-staffed when it comes to ancillary staff. There's no one picking up the phone. There's nobody delivering the food trays. There is nobody cleaning the patients, getting the vitals, turning the patients every 2 hours to prevent bed sores. all of these tasks that we aren't limited to. We can do any of these jobs, but we can't do all of the jobs of the hospital all of the time. It's impossible. Knowing that you're going to deliver subpar care is dehumanizing. It is so shameful because we know what good care is and we know we're capable of it. We know what it looks like. And I hate to be the face on the receiving end for that patient being told that they have to wait for medicine or to eat food or to be cleaned because they soiled themselves, because I literally cannot be in 10 places at once. It's wrong. It's not what any of us wanted to become a nurse for.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine it must be really disillusioning. Go ahead, Aaron.
To add on to that, you know, from the like a more ICU based perspective as well, you know, I'm supposed to have two patients. Some of the ICUs even have a 1-to-1 patient ratio because the patients are so sick. So when you add another patient onto that workload, you're looking at potentially doubling or, you know, adding 50% more workload. And, you know, in the ICU, you know, a lot of our patients are on ventilators. They're getting medications that actually require like minute to minute monitoring and adjustments sometimes, like life support drugs. And, you know, a lot of our handling of, you know, that workflow is based on actually being able to like visibly see both of your patients at the same time. You're listening for the alarms. We work together in teams a lot, and, you know, we'll call a partner over to come help us with stuff. You know, it's not like, even though you have your own two patients, it's not just a one person job. We all work together as a team. And when someone's inundated with extra work to do, another person that they have to listen to a monitor for, or listen to an IV pump for, or a ventilator alarming, you know, it not only makes it more difficult for them to do their job, but it makes it more difficult for the entire floor to work effectively as a team, because it really takes that person out of that dynamic. And it also makes the rest of the team have to work harder to pick up that person's slack too. So, you know, when we're getting these like difficult ratios, it's not even something that you have time to prepare for. It's something when you come in, you find out when you get to work. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you had a bad night's sleep the night before, you know, anything else, like you got to be working at 200% just to get done like what needs to get done to keep people alive. I mean, quite frankly, it's not something that is, you know, to be messed around with. I mean, it's people's lives, it's people's health. When someone gets so sick, you know, a lot of times they can't come back from that. And it really requires a lot of attention, a lot of very delicate, close attention to what you're doing.
No one's health outcome should be impacted by a hospital being somehow unable to supply staff members. But if you don't have safe staffing, especially in these high acuity areas like the ICU, if you don't have eyes on all your patients, people will suffer, and they do. It's so wrong and so avoidable.
It's such an, like David mentioned about like the rail strikes, you know, it's one, I can understand CVS not hiring enough staff, and then, you know, giving profits to shareholders and, you know, not really caring about the staff there. This seems like something that we should not be, yeah, like you said, Aaron, messing around with. This is literal life and death every day. Talk a little bit about COVID, and, you know, I know you don't have a whole bunch of experience pre-COVID, but you mentioned a lot of these problems pre-existed COVID. Just talk about how COVID exacerbated that, and maybe, like, did that bring your sort of awareness to, like, we need to act collectively as a union to address this stuff?
Yeah, so I actually have maybe a bit of an interesting perspective on the COVID thing, because when I first started working at the hospital in 2018, I was actually in one of the very few departments that has nurses working who are not unionized. So I actually worked, it's the dialysis department. I did dialysis in the hospital for about 3 years before I transferred over into the ICU in a unionized unit. So I worked through COVID without a union, regularly 18, 20-hour shifts, coming in, you know, breaking my back, like, you know, just trying to keep people alive. I'm in the rooms with patients where there's not even 6 feet of separation, dialyzing them, you know, back to back to back, you know, we didn't have enough supplies. So we're turning in our N95 masks at the end of our shift to get sterilized and returned to us when we come back the next day. You know, working like 70, 80 hours a week, because there just wasn't any people to come help us. And, you know, we didn't have a choice to say no. There was no way to say, I'm not going to take care of that patient. I'm going to go home because I need to rest. That's not an option. And, you know, during the pandemic, I think a lot of the senior nursing staff, probably across the country, honestly, was, you know, seeing this as like, you know what, I've had my career. This is my time to kind of retire. You know, I don't need to like get myself into this. I've been working for 30 years. I'm getting old. I'm vulnerable. So we did see like a mass exodus of a lot of the senior nurses during the pandemic. Because of that, when new nurses are graduating from nursing school, they're getting out of college, they're coming into this hospital and, you know, other big hospitals, and they don't have the staff to support them. The working conditions are not great. The resources aren't there to, you know, help bolster retention. They're staying in the career for, you know, a year, 2 years, and then they're leaving either to go to a smaller hospital where they'll get paid, you know, the same amount or even more to have like a lower stress job. They're doing, you know, outpatient services, or they're saying, you know what, I could go back to school, do another 2 years, become a nurse practitioner, and then I don't have to work at the bedside with patients. So, you know, a lot of what we're striking for with safe staffing, we know that if we are able to secure a contract that has this in policy, you know, it's not going to turn things around overnight, but we're looking at a long-term goal here of, you know, the hospital, obviously the reason they don't want to enforce it is because it hurts their profit. So if there's some kind of financial risk for them to keep us short-staffed and there's no financial incentive for them to maintain low staffing ratios, it's going to actually force the, you know, executive board to do what their job is and find creative solutions to these types of problems, whether that means, you know, some kind of retention bonuses, investing in nursing schools, and just, you know, general things that they can do to make the workplace better for us. If that's what they have to do, that's what they have to do, because the system as it is not sustainable. We're seeing nurses are coming in, they're not staying. Older nurses are retiring at much higher rates than before, and something has to change.
I worked as an EMT throughout COVID. I got my EMT license when I was 17, and I stopped when I became a nurse. And I also worked in the ER at the hospital we work at as a tech throughout COVID for a couple of years. And so I was always in that setting throughout the peak of COVID for the next like 2 years through it. There were so many travelers in the ER that it was unrecognizable. You didn't know who people were anymore when I had been working with those people for a long time already. It was shocking to see how many people had left because there was a mass exodus of people who were already considering retiring. So many people went into early retirement. And while being in nursing school at the same time, while all of this was going on, with the college that the hospital has the greatest relationship with to try to recruit new grads and get people into the field, there was a sense of nursing is not sustainable anymore. This is not a career that you can do your whole life anymore. Because if we go through global health emergencies, if people consistently have multiple comorbidities, if the American population is generally unhealthier, and something like coronavirus can take down so many people and just inundate our health system, then you need to have a backup plan as a nurse. Nobody wants to be a bedside nurse as a career anymore, but it shouldn't be that way. Because it's an extremely rewarding career. There's no such thing as being just a nurse and needing to go back to school and do something else, because there's nothing better that you can do than, if what you want to do is provide care for people, then do it directly at the bedside. And our career is struggling because we have been given so many tasks that are not our own, and being stretched so thin with so little staffing, not just in our hospital, but across the nation.
Yeah, you mentioned travelers and travel nurses, and I wanted to ask that too, because that seems like not a great sign. I know somebody who's going through nursing school right now, and you know, from a young nurse's standpoint, where you're, especially if you're indebted, I can understand why the top line of salary or how much you're going to earn in a couple weeks traveling to some hospital and filling in, you know, like you'd say, spots. They pay a lot, but that's they have to pay that because one, like. I imagine even psychically as a travel nurse, like you're going into situations that are short-staffed by definition, or they wouldn't be calling you. And so you're put in this situation where you're here's a lot of extra money to do an inadequate job. And how many people are going to want to do that? Like even for the huge amounts, but I'm just curious, like your perspectives on the travelers, and you've already mentioned it, Sophia, like the difficulty knowing who's around you and the institutional knowledge of like where stuff is and how stuff is done in a certain hospital.
Yeah. The travelers aren't given a lot of orientation time, especially in the case of our strike. They were onboarded within days and weren't trained by staff nurses who were on the premises. So they were off of the hospital grounds, in offices, in computer labs, learning the computer system, doing everything that they could do to be as prepared as possible to take over care. And I've worked with a lot of really great travelers. I have nothing against people doing what they need to do and filling that role, because it obviously exists, but it is clearly not a long-term solution. And travel rates are not what they were during coronavirus. They were insane, and you can make so much money traveling, but that money is running out. Because the trend to go become a traveler, the supply is not meeting the demand. We have so many people who leave the bedside now to go make more money in that role. But not only are there so many issues with traveling, you don't get enough time to onboard. You don't necessarily know the system. You're more inclined to make errors or mistakes. You don't know what you're doing if you don't work at the hospital for so long. And it doesn't promote retention or continuity of care. The money also just isn't there anymore for a lot of people, because if hospitals rely so heavily on travelers and people continue to leave the hospital to travel, it's going to equal out eventually. It's just not sustainable. It's going to crash.
Yeah. I also want to add to that, you know, I think something that really gets heavily overlooked when it comes to staffing an entire hospital, or, you know, relying on travelers to fill out large gaps in staffing, is, you know, a lot of people coming into the, you know, different areas and everything may not be as, you know, educated on the culture of that area. You know, in Jersey, and, you know, especially in New Brunswick, we have a very, very diverse cultural population, and a lot of those cultural considerations need to be taken into account when it comes to people's care. So, you know, when you have nurses coming in large swaths from, you know, maybe more rural areas, that, you know, the nurses may not have a lot of experience dealing with, you know, like a very dense Indian population or Hasidic Jewish population or a Muslim population, that, you know, there's, you know, different quirks to working with different people that, you know, they don't get just educated on during their onboarding. It's something that, you know, they have to be either told on the job, or it needs to be, you know, or it can create an awkward or difficult situation for a family or something like that. And, you know, I think it's just not really the right approach. That being said, I also want to say there's levels to the travel nursing thing, especially in terms of the strike, because there is actually an industry of scab nurses. There are nursing agencies that are set up specifically to staff hospitals during strikes to try and relieve pressure from the hospital put on by the union. The nurses who actually sign up to work with these agencies go into it knowing that they're going in there to help break a strike. But there are also other travel nursing agencies that the nurses sign up for thinking it's a regular travel gig, and they sign the contract and it's kept hidden from them. that they're actually going to be working at a striking hospital. So I would advise if any nurses are listening to not pick up a travel contract in New Brunswick. And if you are a prospective nurse or prospective traveling nurse, try and do some research into the hospital that you're going to, because it's very possible that you could be going in there to break a strike and you might be crossing a picket line without even knowing it. So I would say that that's definitely something to look out for and keep in mind when it comes to like travel nurses.
Yeah, I'll let you go, Dave, but I wasn't fortunate enough to see some TikTok activity of people defending travel nurse in scabbing, and it's like, come on, guys, let's wind it in a little bit. Go ahead, David.
I mean, yeah, I think we played it on the show, Matt. It was pretty rough, but I was just hoping maybe we could take it to the strike a little bit and y'all could talk about the tactics, you know, how long y'all have been on there. And also, you know, talk about the, you know, the political side of it, like your ability to picket and do things like that. Cause that's obviously an important part of the story as well.
Yeah. So today is day 75 of the strike. We went on strike on August 4th, pretty much for the first like 60 days. Negotiations were almost non-existent. Anytime that the hospital did meet with us, it was because they were called on by the federal mediator, and it was just bad faith negotiations. They refused to budge on anything. They took away our health insurance at the end of August. It was obviously an attempt by the hospital to try and make us more desperate, to just take whatever contract they put on the table. But, you know, the union has been very strong. No one's crossed the picket line. What the hospital has been doing to try and break our union actually has been like just disgusting. What they've done several times since the beginning of the strike is they'll actually send text messages to the entire nursing staff directly, going over the heads of the union leadership, feeding us propaganda, trying to turn us against our union, trying to tear us apart. I think it's kind of backfired on them because it's really gotten people more fired up and it's kind of gone to show like how they feel about us. But, you know, we've just been getting extremely patronizing text messages. Robert Wood Johnson is a very powerful political entity. They sponsor a lot of the media in the area. So we have been facing a coordinated media blackout. 1,700 nurses on strike for 2.5 months, you would think would be a bigger deal than what you see, you know, just casually browsing, you know, even like labor-centric publications, you know, there's really not a lot of coverage. And it's because it's been silenced at the source, you know. There's local news just has not really been too interested in covering us. You know, the CEO of our hospital is also on the board of governors at Rutgers University, and he was appointed by Governor Murphy. So there's definitely some like deep-seated political connections that the hospital has there. You know, it's been a very difficult battle because we just don't have the resources that the hospital has. And the strongest thing that we do have is our message, because it's such a common sense thing, you know, even just like separating the line between like a nurse and a patient. You know, I don't see myself as being like on a different tier of person than the people I take care of, because everyone has a body. Everyone's going to get sick at some point. You know, if my family or my friends get sick, like that's the hospital they're going to go to. Like, I want it to be a good hospital because it's the hospital my community uses. You know what I mean? So hurting us from being able to spread that message to our community, it's been really detrimental. I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that, Sophia.
I agree. I grew up in the area and I always wanted to work at Robert Wood. I always wanted to go to Rutgers, work at Robert Wood, be a nurse. I had one dream and here it is. It's been really disappointing, especially since this was the hospital I went to as a kid. This was the hospital my family members use. I have relatives who've worked in the hospital. It's well known that for a long time it was revered as the best place you could possibly work, and there was a waiting list to get a job there. Now they can't hold staff, and it's because the culture has changed and the priorities have changed, and it's no longer about staff. It's no longer about caring for one another and making sure that we can do a good job and we're well supplied and we have the resources and the people to do a good job. It's about costs, and it doesn't feel the way it used to. It doesn't feel like somewhere you should be really proud and excited to work at. It's been a letdown, especially with, like you said, Erin, the kind of messaging that we're getting from the hospital as we continue to be on strike, the different tactics that they have used to weaken our resolve and otherwise make us doubt the point of our message and force us to question if what we're doing is the right thing, maligning us constantly in the media and getting on our back about, are we too loud on the picket line? Or are we disrupting traffic when it's our First Amendment right to do what we're doing and to fight for our patients? And it's what we should do. It's been really, really disgusting.
And the injunctions.
And the injunctions, yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so we actually got picket line injunctions put in place about 2 or 3 weeks ago now, that pretty much prevents us from having more than 15 people out of a base of 1,700, clustered together. Everyone has to be more than 20 feet apart. We're not allowed to use bullhorns.
I don't know how we talk about free speech in this country. And it's all about, like, are the racists too moderated on social media? Like, you literally have all these people you could bring to a picket line, and the court's like, nah. And I don't understand how. I mean, I understand why, but legally I don't understand how.
It's free speech until it makes our corporation look bad, and it disturbs the community because it's too loud that you're asking for the ability to take care of them so that you don't worry that you're going to walk into work one day and accidentally kill them. It's free speech until you make us look bad.
Right.
Because, like, but that's the thing is, like, what you said about, like, the pride in that. I'm from, you know, Bismarck, North Dakota, and the hospitals in that city are like, yeah, we'd like to have these hospitals here. These are a pride of the city. And that we can see in front of our eyes, these be turned into something being hollowed out by profiteers that have no sort of connection to actually delivering care. Like, this is, like, we talk about, like, it's not just the health thing. It's, like, having pride in your society. You should not look at the hospital down the street and be like, yeah, they can't even, that floor I'm looking at from the outside, not even enough nurses on there to treat the patients.
New Brunswick is called the healthcare city for a reason. It has two major academic centers, a giant university. It has more research than most Big Ten universities. There should be so much support for what we're fighting for. It's really, they've shown their true colors. It's not what they care about.
We're healthcare heroes until, you know, we speak up and try to do something heroic and help the community, and then all of a sudden, you know, we're villainized. So.
Hey, well, guys, I'll clap for you at my window if that helps.
No pop in hand, because that's exactly. Too loud.
Yeah, no pop in hand.
Yeah, a little bit of recognition. Well, how can people help? What can people do to give you guys aid? Where should we direct people?
Right. So, first I want to say we've been getting, like, a huge support from the community that we've actually been able to reach, and a lot of the other unions in the area. Our biggest ally through the strike has actually been, like, the Rutgers AAUP AFT union, which they just had their historic strike back in the spring. They've been huge. DSA, PSL, Our Revolution, they've all been big supporters. How can people help? I would say number one is, again, if you're a traveling nurse, don't take a contract in New Brunswick. You're hurting our strike. Number two, we have social media channels that you can follow for updates. We're on Facebook and Instagram at RWJ Nurses United. I also am co-chairing a new coalition that we're forming to actually unify nurses and nursing unions across the state with community organizations. I think one of the big fights that we know is that, you know, because our hospital is such a big major hospital, it really sets the bar for healthcare across the state. So whatever victory we're able to get is going to be widespread. So I want to really openly, publicly organize with nurses and other nursing unions. So if you're a nurse in New Jersey, or if you know a nurse, we have a website that we set up, safestaffingnj.org. You can get in touch with us about joining our coalition. Whether you're in a union or not, like, please reach out. The last thing is, there are bills that are actually sitting at the state level, proposed bills that need to be passed through. So that's Bill S-304 and A-4536, which actually are what the coalition is trying to put pressure on politicians to pass. So call your legislators and ask them to please, you know, push those bills through.
Sophia and Aaron, I can't thank you guys enough, and the rest of your union and nurses for fighting for this. And yeah, keep in touch any way that we can help down the line. You know, thanks so much for, you know, going out on limb for workers and patients, and, you know, everybody who wants to be have pride in their society. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks
for having us on.
Folks, yeah, it was a real honor to talk to people who are really doing the work, not just their actual job, but also the labor movement. So thanks so much to Aaron and Sophia there. Yeah, and do the right thing. New York nurses, I think I wish I had Sudip's article up. We'll link to it if it's not
in the show notes for people.
You know, this is a demand that hospitals give into, and 75 days is too long. This should have been given into, but do the right thing and, you know, staff your fucking hospitals the way, like, the evidence suggests you need to. Why? I'm not a radical here. Like, this is, like you said, like, it's actually a throwback to my old self, like the old pre-Marxist Matt, where I was into, like, skepticism and stuff like that. The evidence-based medicine, baby. Like, don't be fucking around with that. Come on. And if you do have to, then guess what? You shouldn't be in charge of running hospitals in the first place. And another system needs to take the place of that.
I think you're right. Well, folks, thank you so much for hanging out with us on Left Reckoning 140. We're going to jump over to postgame, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access. Come over and hang out with Matt and I a little bit over there. I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about. Take your calls and questions and a few things from the archives. So come by and hang out.
See you, folks.